Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. It is the 24th of October, 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. Do you know where your East Wing is? It is wonderful to have you on the program. We thank you for being here, and it is a delight to end the week with you. We have a lot going on. We will get right to it. I will introduce the panelists, and we will start. Just real quickly, I want to mention two things. One is that Susan Stamberg, one of NPR's founding mothers, passed away last week. We were at Bard last week on Friday. And but NPR did a beautiful special, and we're going to play that this morning at 11 o'clock to remember Susan Stamberg. She was NPR for so long, and I think anyone even in the periphery of NPR has had some dealing and has a Susan Stamberg story. And it's really it's sad, but it's also, I remember the museum in when it was in Washington. Right down from the Capitol. It's not there anymore. But one of the main artifacts they had in the history of news gathering was Susan Stamberg's first recording kit. And I remember just like standing there staring at it, thinking it was the coolest thing in the world. I wonder where that is now, because it was weirdly positioned next to Ted Kaczynski's cabin in the museum. But anyway, I digress.
It was a strange museum.
It was a strange museum. You're absolutely right. So we'll remember Susan Stamberg coming up in our 11 o'clock hour in an NPR special. So we hope you'll join us for that. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College. Bo Breslin is here. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I am well, thanks. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. Bill Hammond joins us, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. You know, you're reminding me, I went to the museum not long after I'd been laid off from a newspaper job, and they had a T-shirt there that said, "We'll write for food." And I bought that T-shirt, and I wore it with pride. It became my slogan. And to this day, I'm still writing for food.
Writing for food. That's right. I often say that in a different context. I'll say, we'll work for food. You know, people ask you to do odd things, and you're like, oh, okay. I'll do that for food. But yeah, it was a weird, it was a cool museum. But then I don't know. It sort of lost its way.
Like, how does Ted Kaczynski's cabin fit into, like, it was almost anything could have been in that museum.
Yeah,
because anything could be in the newspaper.
Anything that was covered. They had a lot of 9/11. They had a lot of I was always fascinated by, like, the action news Channel 6 copter that was sort of hovering over the top of the museum. Very cool. Chief of Staff and Vice President of Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thanks.
Very nice to have you here. And we welcome the audience, panel at WAMC.org. If you'd like to join us, panel at WAMC.org. And goodness, why wouldn't you want to join us? All right, let's talk about what is happening in the news. And we could start on several different stories, but I'm going to go with the fact that the East Wing is gone. And now, this is in the Washington Post story, the East Wing is gone and Trump turns to damage control. Demolition crews finished taking down the White House wing Thursday while President Trump defended the project. They're now, if you've waded into your feeds at all, if you have them, you will have seen the aerial pictures, no doubt, of the before and after of what it looked like from the sky. With a West Wing and without, and it is
the East Wing.
East Wing. I apologize. Yeah. The East Wing, somewhat troubling. Wrecking crews had completely removed the decades-old annex by midday Thursday, just 3 days after they started to make way for a pet project of Donald Trump, a 90,000 square foot ballroom. The teardown, which The Washington Post first reported Monday prompted a massive backlash from historic preservationists and Democrats who accused Trump of destroying a national landmark and doing so under a cloak of secrecy. The rapidity of this really is surprising, considering it started on Monday, it finished on Thursday, and we are where we are. I mean, it wasn't like you could jump in and save it. There was a historic preservation group within the city and said that we want to do a 6-week study of this to stop the project. And I was like, it's gone. TikTok.
Too late.
It's gone. Right. The work also drew thousands of tourists to Pennsylvania Avenue this week to watch, or rather listen to the heavy machinery. The Trump administration has restricted the public from most vantage points. This includes the Treasury Department adjacent, and they have been ordered and signed waivers not to share photos and escorted journalists away trying to shoot video. Because they were hoping people wouldn't notice that a third of the building was gone. The little that remained just after lunchtime Thursday included a small portion of the East Colonnade, a corridor that previously connected the East Wing to the main house. The section was jagged with damage, exposed brick, and dangling wire, according to photographs obtained by the Post, and two people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the scene. Instead of leading to the offices of the First Lady, the severed walkway opened to towering piles of concrete and steel and the cacophony of excavators roving the demolition site. The East Wing will be replaced by a ballroom, offices for the First Lady and her staff, as well as new guest suites for the president's White House guests, according to a project description on the resume of lead architect James McCrary II. Malia.
He's trying to turn the White House into Mar-a-Lago mid-Atlantic. And I'm sure that Bo and Bill will have some thoughts to share about what this process is with or should be with oversight and all that. But I've been thinking about what this means culturally and how this ties into how autocrats behave. So when I think of ballrooms in this country, the kind of affairs that usually take place, what are the biggest, most glittering events that American society has to offer? It's usually the first thing that comes to mind is the Oscars or things like that, right?
And Met Gala, Oscars.
Met Gala, yes, things like that, that are, whether you like exactly how they play out, they are honoring artists. They are highlighting art. Maybe in sometimes in a gaudy way, but that's what they do, and that's what our society has elevated over the years. And so I can't help wondering what kind of events does Trump plan to have in this ballroom? It's surely not going to be the Oscars of the East. He's going to want to have more military themed events, that's what I anticipate is going to be coming out of this, and it's just building on his brand and trying to strengthen this rising autocratic autocratically enabled segment of American society that is celebrating not art, not storytelling, which storytelling is one of the first things to die in a society where democracy is floundering, right? Because you have to. That's what an autocrat will put blinkers on first is an ability to tell stories, whether it's journalists, whether it's artists. So the events that are going to take place in this ballroom are not going to be highlighting free storytelling. They're going to be highlighting the narrative that he wants to put out of strength and power.
Well said. Let me build off what Malia just said by and say a couple of things. Joe, first of all, thanks for putting this topic back on the agenda. I think a lot of people out there wonder why this is important, and Malia just said it. I'm sure Bill will say it in a second why it's important. I'll try to contribute to it by starting by quoting Lincoln. Lincoln, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Now, he's talking about slavery, but there is a sort of ironic metaphor here in light of the tribalism and polarization of America. I was at the gym this morning, and I'm looking at Fox News because the Fox and CNN are right next to each other at the Wilton Y. The story on Fox News was, who cares? Like, the nobody cares about this. And the person he was interviewing said some version of, when folks are having barbecues and watching Saturday and Sunday football games, nobody's talking about the East Wing. And CNN obviously had a different slant on it. I'm going to throw something out there that I think is important and lost in the media, and that is the notion of symbolism. Let's have a conversation about how symbolism is important in America. It's been part of the history of and tradition of this country, and the symbolism of this moment and this particular destructive construction project is real, right? Symbolism of the expansion the expansion of the White House when government is in shutdown seems odd to me. The symbolism of largesse when the GOP stands for small government seems odd to me. The symbolism of destroying the people's house, again, a house divided against itself cannot stand, the metaphor that Lincoln was talking about. The symbolism of sort of starting this project right on practically the day of the No Kings protest. The symbolism of ostentation in a White House that was built for democratic humility, right? The point of, and it was built by enslaved peoples, right? Let's not forget that. The symbolism of ostentation, as Malia points out, with the gold 90,000 square foot celebration of celebrity, when the White House was built to demonstrate humility. It is not Buckingham Palace or Versailles, and it was not meant to be that. The symbolism of the value of democracy, the House is the embodiment of popular sovereignty. The White House is the embodiment of all men are created equal. The revolutionary period was the spirit with which the White House was built, not the celebrity status of the 21st century. And so the symbolism of what he's doing in light of just an ignorance, an utter ignorance of all that was conventional, historical, and so on in the past strikes me as problematic. Now, I'm going to defer to Bill here, but at the risk of perhaps overstepping my bounds, Joe, I hope you can come back to me because I've got a tiny little beef with Mark Whitman from yesterday's show that I'd like to chat about.
Ooh, all right. I do want to hear from Bill. I was struck by what you said about, because I've seen this coverage a lot of, you know, who will care? Who cares? Who cares? Who cares? And no one's going to be talking about this, which I know this is anecdotal, but I will tell you over the last 4 days where I go, and I realize I go in different circles than a lot of people at Fox News, but that is what everyone wants to talk about. I mean, it is because it's so striking. It's something that really sort of tears apart at you of figuring it out.
It's the people's house.
It's the people's house, and I don't know. Amazing. Bill.
That detail you cited where the administration is asking, it's restricting access to the viewpoints, to the vantage points where you can see the demolition going on, and they're telling people in the Treasury Department next door not to share photos. I think that speaks volumes about how sort of viscerally upsetting it is to see a bulldozer tearing down part of the White House. Like, I think the country invests a lot in symbols of our democracy. If you've ever been to Washington, it's one of the first things you want to do is go to the Capitol and just see it, and then go to the White House and see it. And like, wow, I've seen that on TV all my life, and there it is. It's in real living color. And to see a bulldozer or whatever, a front loader, pulling down part of that structure is upsetting. And so I think, I buy into the idea that a building like the White House needs event space. I was reading some of the coverage today, and they're quoting people from former administrations in both parties saying, yeah, we needed a ballroom. We would have these big events. They were supposed to be glittering affairs. We're inviting international leaders, and we're eating under a tent on the lawn. And so they didn't think that was, there was a point of view that the White House needed a better space to hold events like that. So you build support for that idea by going to the public and explaining, we need an event space. And here's my proposal for what it should look like. And here's my plan for building it and how I'm going to use it. Instead, we wake up one morning and a front loader is pulling down a third of the White House. I think there is a time when you're going to manhandle a national symbol, you need to explain to the public what you're doing and why. And that just didn't happen here.
One thing, I mentioned this yesterday, but I think one thing that really struck me, and then when we come back from the break, I'll let Bo go after Mark, that when they were working on the Rose Garden, which now resembles like a patio at an Orange Julius in Tampa,
right?
They said, there were architects that said, well, you know, at an appropriate time, we can restore this back to what it was. That's not the case here.
Nope.
This is done. This is a finality to that building, to that project. And so I do think that is, and also a key thing that I think has to be drummed into people's brains endlessly is the fact that as of July 31st, the president said that the building would not be touched. So there's that as well.
I mean, it's really hard to escape the metaphor for the political situation, right? That there are a lot of people in this country, myself included, who don't like the way the president is trampling on norms all over the place. And not just norms, but also like laws and constitutional clauses. And for that to be realized in physical form,
yeah,
it's kind of hard to escape that resonance. And it, you know, you could imagine another president doing renovations at the White House. It happens a lot.
I want to pause you there. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, talking about the East Wing of the White House gone this morning, and Trump now turning to damage control as people see these images, even though it's hard to get a good image of it, although through satellite imagery and other photos that have become available, you get a pretty good sense of what it is. And I mean, not to be flip about it, but let's just simplify it. Of what was there isn't anymore. So there's that. Bo Breslin.
Yeah, so I'm always a huge fan when Mark Whitman is on the show. He was on the show yesterday. It was a terrific show. And I think, you know, just as a footnote before I start in on Mark, one of the letter writers was just flat out wrong in sort of accusing him. So listeners, go back to listen to yesterday's conversation. It was very good. But Mark was wrong about one thing and one thing centrally. Mark Whitman's point about the East Wing, as I understand it, is, and he had a slight positive, he said, I don't like Trump, I don't like what's happening here and all that sort of stuff, so I have to contextualize it. But he had a slight positive, he called it a nugget, where he said the one thing that he appreciated about this particular event was that Trump was getting things done. And he had Mark said that that's the problem with democracies around the world, is that they're not getting things done. And here Trump is able to get things done. And I'm throwing stuff at the radio because ultimately
that's what that was.
Yeah. Ultimately, that's not the system we have. And it's never been the system we have. Our system, designed by the architects in Philadelphia in 1787 and what's still with us, is a system where the point of checks and balances and so on is deliberation. It is about compromise. It's about thoughtful reflection. It's not about rapid, swift getting things done. That's autocratic regimes around the world. Ironically, some of the democracies have turned to the right and they're getting things done as Mark wants things to happen. But until our system changes, and until the system of checks and balances, where each institution of government has a stake in the outcome of policy made by other institutions of the federal government, until that changes, it's not about swiftness and getting things done. It's about contemplating compromise and deliberation for the public good.
So I don't want to speak on Mark's behalf, and I don't want to because I'm just not that smart. But let me just say what I took his remarks to be at the time was that it was more of the perception, in the sense that one of the reasons that people get aggravated at government is that it takes so long to do things, as opposed to a situation where, damn it, you just go out and get it done.
Okay, so Joe, I'll give you complete credit that you interpreted him correctly, and I'll say that that's Mark. That's still not what the system that we have.
So that's still BS.
I mean, there's always a tension between the deliberation that's built into our system and the need to get things done. Like that is actually important.
Yeah.
I think one of the great symbols of the Democratic Party is FDR, who, that was like, he took office and it was the Depression. He's like, we've got to do something about the Depression. Whatever it is, we're going to do it. And he set up all these agencies, and they did go through Congress, but it went through Congress like the proverbial stuff through a goose. And when the Supreme Court said it wasn't constitutional, he threatened to pack the Supreme Court. He was being forceful in a way that people liked. And the Democratic Party has lionized him ever since. So there are situations where we want people to get things done. I don't think tearing down part of the White House is one of them. And it's not on the list.
I mean, I'll say one more thing. You know, Madison did not want there to be a government shutdown. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about deliberation and contemplation and compromise and so on. This very hard navigation through the political system. Madison did not want government to be shut down. He also didn't anticipate the modern consumerism, where we, you know, and I'm going to be a little flippant here, where we have a tantrum when we don't get something immediately, right? The reality is politics is a slog, and that's the system we have. It's not a quick fix. And the reason why it's not a quick fix is morally right. That is, we're trying to make decisions for the best interest of the public at large, the polity at large. So my beef is with both the perception and the sense that somehow we should be moving quickly and getting things done, because that's not the system we have.
I think that's what one of the things that Trump is envious about of dictatorial systems is they can just wave a wand and something happens. Now, that something happened might be, you know, okay, the Great Wall was built because a Chinese emperor said the Great Wall should be built. Well, guess what? There are like thousands of people who died while they were building it. Nobody talks about that. But it's interesting you mentioned Madison, because these are the kind of nerdy conversations I have with my friends. I'm in a text group with some of my friends. We were actually talking about what Madison failed to anticipate. This is in my text group. This is what we do for fun. The large scale loss of collective goodwill, yeah. Like civic goodwill towards our neighbors, is something that that I think they didn't anticipate. And I'm sure there's some theorists out there, democratic theorists, who'd say, well, maybe democracy can't work in a system this large. Although, you know, we look at India. India is larger than the United States. Their democracy is not exactly efficient and perfect, but it's chugging along in its own slogging way. Maybe part of what we're seeing is maybe there are limits on the size of democracy. I don't know. I'd be interested in political theorists' thoughts on that.
You know, there's the common sense side to this, too. I mean, I think anybody who's ever lived in or rented an apartment, I mean, I've just, you know, you go in and you're like, oh, can I put a nail hole in here? Is that going to be okay? Yeah. Like, you know, am I going to get my deposit back? You know, and you're like concerned about it. And then to just say, well, to hell with it, I'm going to do whatever I want. Man, it just seems, right. I mean, obviously you don't care. And I think in saying, which the White House has been saying over the last several days, that they didn't need any approvals, they could do whatever they wanted. I don't know where that lies, but
there's a tradition in this country, in particular a tradition among presidents, of having a reverence for the job, the Constitution, the symbolism. And I think it's real. You hear all the time about when one president leaves office, he'll leave a letter to the next president.
Right.
And it will be the beginning of a friendship, maybe not a close friendship, but you know, across party lines or whatever. When you see, you know, when there's a big funeral and all the presidents are sitting together, I think
that with George W. Bush and
Bill Clinton.
And Obama.
There's a brotherhood. The relationships that they have had.
Yes.
And that was the way those relationships were built, was by sort of visibly living out reverence for the Constitution and the job. And in one of the stories about this East Wing situation, there was kind of a side note about this hallway that was put up that has portraits of all the presidents, and they're in kind of gaudy gold frames. All of the presidents except Biden. Biden's portrait is a picture of an auto pen machine somehow. So it's like this dig at Trump's predecessor, which obviously came straight from Trump himself. I don't want to see Biden's portrait, which just shows such a disdain. Not for Biden. I mean, that's fair if he wants to disdain Biden. But he's showing a disdain for the presidency. He's showing a disdain for the office. And now he's showing, in some sense, he's showing a disdain for the building.
Which
it's the people's building. He's treating it as if it's his personal property. And that's the symbolism of what's, to me, that's part of what makes this upsetting.
I had heard about the auto pen thing, and I just saw the photo the other day of it, but what also struck me is that Trump's portrait is his mugshot.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, wow.
So the other thing that's interesting about this, and riffing off of Bill and Joe, is the dilemma that the Democrats face. I go to this a lot. I think about this a lot. There's a great article, by the way, today in the New York Times by David Brooks about the rot. And he's basically, Bill, talking about the way that you and Malia were talking about in a second. But the Democrats are in a dilemma. I've said a lot in public settings that the game of politics has changed. Trump has changed the game of politics, and Democrats are desperate to get back to Bill, that dignity, that sort of those conventions, those guardrails that that managed the presidency for 230 years. Democrats are trying to get back there, but the game has changed so dramatically that now Democrats are starting to, as David Brooks says, go into the basement with Trump and disparage some of the traditional conventions and dignity that made American presidential politics so elegant and effective.
I mean, there's definitely tradition in this country of expressing disdain for institutions. Like that's like a cherished tradition.
For sure.
Having grown up in the 60s and 70s, I think a lot of that came from the left. But once you got into the White House, you were supposed to like put that aside, right? Like I'm in the White House now. I'm the leader of the free world. You go along with the ceremony and the tradition and like there's important reasons for doing that that as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate.
Let's take a break. We have many letters on this. We'll get to those right after this break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We go to letters this morning, and we begin with Liz. I heard that regarding the West Wing, I heard that that was the visitor's entrance. Can we all see that this is deliberate in setting up no more visitors allowed in the White House / our house, which is a good point. Although I will say, I don't know what the case. It was never, easy to get into the White House.
And I think he wants more visitors to fill up this ballroom.
Yeah,
he wants to show it off.
And I'm not. I'm just saying that I know I have tried many times to go into to get a tour. Or to go through the White House, and you have to go through your congressional representative, and there's you know, like 5 days a year that you can, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm not saying, I understand the point of the letter, and that's absolutely true. It's just also, I don't think it was ever all that easy to do. Let's see, we go to Suzanne, it's not ignorance of the history, value, context, and symbolism of the White House. It's utter and an intentional disdain. And we all know when it's done that the new Epstein ballroom will be tacky as hell. I find myself thinking about the workers operating the demolition equipment and whether any refused. Then we go to this letter. From Jeff, what is the legal justification for Trump tearing down the East Wing? It is government property, not his. He is a temporary occupant. What can be done? Well, I think those are the questions, right?
Yeah, man. The answer is nothing. I heard on Morning Edition, I heard this morning that they were talking to somebody in the National Preservation Society, Heritage, White House Heritage, what sounded official to me. And she said there is no limitation. She's the one who's trying to preserve it. She said there is no limitation on what a president can do in this particular construction project. The other thing I'll say, Joe.
It's an area where we've just depended on norms. You know, sensibilities.
Do we have to write a rule about this? Well, it's not like somebody's going to come in and tear down part of the White House.
Right. The other thing that's interesting about this is I'd love to know the demographics of the construction workers, right? So how many of them are undocumented workers that are working the project, right? And isn't there some irony in thinking about that construction project while he's trying to expel as many undocumented immigrants as possible? I don't know what that looks like, but I would love to know.
I saw a TV host introducing a story about this topic. He was on Fox, and he said something to the effect of all the things for Democrats to be upset about, they're focused on this. And part of my reaction was, you know, actually, the people who are upset with the president have quite a long list of things that they're angry about. This is one of many. It just happens to be the one that's going on in our faces this week. So it's like, you know, the idea that you shouldn't talk about it because there are other more important things in the world. There are, of course, many more important things in the world. But this is, it's happening now. It came as a shock and a surprise because the president did not let us in on his plans. So, you know, that's why people are talking about it.
Well, and I think also to Beau's earlier point, which was very well stated, the symbolism of it. It's not just this. It's a symbol of so many other things that I think is why it's not that people are just upset about this one thing. It's just that it symbolizes so many other things that are happening.
Can I ask you the three of you a question? And I'll direct this at Joe. So is the timing coincidental? Right. So, yeah, you got to get some of this stuff happening. But, you know, we knew that the No Kings protest was going to happen on the Sunday and they started the construction project on the Monday. Sometimes I think this stuff we think Trump is oblivious, like ignorant, whatever. I think a lot of this stuff is calculated.
I think in his evil way, he's a strategic genius.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, is there a link to the horrible video where he was, you know, in the plane, taking sewage over the people on No King's Day, and now, you know, this is a way of burning down the house, as it were, literally, but also, I mean, to me, the other tell is the shutdown. I mean, just that how. Like a lot of work. The only work in Washington really being done right now
is steamrolling.
So, I do not. I want to go on the record saying I do not believe that this was timed because of the No Kings protest. Because it, you know, having done some renovation work on my own house, it's not easy to get contractors to show up exactly when you want them to. But what President Trump is good at is constantly having something new that he's doing that draws attention. He is the master of drawing attention. He, like, just this morning, there was some ad that Canada ran on TV about tariffs that quoted President Reagan. Trump is now alleging that the ad was misquoting President Reagan, although I think there's some dispute about that. And because of that ad, he's going to cut off trade talks with Canada, you know, about getting, about pulling down tariffs. He can, like, I'm sure before I'm on the show again, which will probably be next week, there will be some new outrage. Like, there's something always coming down the pipeline. And this was just one of 300 things that has happened since he took office.
I think both can be true, though. I agree with you, but I think also that this could be of, and I don't know, if you take him at his word.
Can't even finish that sentence with a straight face, can you?
If you take
start that sentence over, Joe.
If you and you say that this was the original plan, and then the White House, and then the contractors came in and said, and architects came in and said, well, it wouldn't be structurally sound, so we're going to have to do this, and this. So if you buy that, then it is something that I would say, okay, so that this one had no relationship to the other, although it does beg the question of then why wasn't that reported and told to the American people. But which does then lead to Beau's question,
which is that you have something, and really what you were just saying, I mean, you have something, it ticks you off, you get, you have this visceral reaction to what you see about Canada, and then you're just like, oh, they don't like this? Well, let's just take down the whole damn thing.
I mean, you know, what was it, last week he was starting a war with Venezuela? I mean, like, there's...
Still is.
But our, like... You have to keep a list because there's so many things going on at any one time. It's hard to keep track. Yeah.
All right. Couple letters and then we'll move on to other stuff. When I used to work on houses, writes Ross, I did a number of historic buildings. The amount of paperwork that I had to go through to change a doorknob was extensive to think that it's all right to tear down a portion of a historic building is absolutely crazy. I can't think of another word because it would be considered swearing. Period. I understand that we have an excessive amount of there's a lot of verbs missing in this letter. This is not a minor renovation in putting a monstrosity up that would dwarf the White House. All of this is unthinkable. That from Russ. Then we go to Lexi. What on earth are you all smoking this morning? Or what was slipped into your coffee? Mm. Trump has never been a leader, and America is no longer a free country or democracy. I don't know that we said anything that would contradict that, but okay. Right. Let's see. We have... this note from Andy, this is Donald Trump's Marie Antoinette moment. His quote-unquote donors should put this money towards feeding America's hungry, housing America's unhoused, many of them veterans who made huge sacrifices for our freedom. Forget about the historic destruction. Let's take care of the present. Then we go to... this from Steve. These are not the actions of a person who is planning to vacate the White House at the end of his current term. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. We welcome your letters, and we have another 45 minutes or so. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back to new topics with our terrific panel after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. I hope you're all still there. Let's see. We have a breaking news, which we just talked about a little bit. You heard. But inflation rose less than expected in September. The U.S. belatedly reports consumer prices rose 3.0% in September from a year ago, slightly below forecasters' expectations, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. So that is information that we have this morning as well. I want to talk about the sanctions on Russian oil. We did talk about this yesterday, but it was had just happened, and now we're seeing some of the impact of that. President Trump ratcheted America's economic war with Russia to a higher level on Wednesday by moving to cut off its two largest oil companies from the global financial system, signaling a new willingness by the U.S. to cripple the U.S. energy sector despite the risk of higher oil prices. The decision to impose sanctions went beyond previous efforts to hamper Russia's economy and demonstrate the extent of Mr. Trump's frustration with Russian President Vladimir Putin. After months of failed talks to end the war in Ukraine, although the sanctions hit just two companies, they have the potential, if strictly enforced, to strike a major blow to the Russian economy by sapping it of energy revenues. This reporting from the New York Times and Alan Rappaport. The move represents a striking shift in strategy from Mr. Trump, who has largely refrained from punishing Russia and has questioned the effectiveness of sanctions after the Biden administration imposed sanctions on about 5,000 Russian targets from 2022 to 2024. Mr. Trump, until this week, had imposed none. What do we make of this, Bill?
I mean, it seems like directionally, you sort of wish this had happened sooner, because this is oil is the source of cash. Like, it's this huge source of money for the Russian economy. It's in effect, it's where Putin has been getting money to finance his war. It's also, like, it's preventing the Russian economy from tanking. And up until now, presidents and other, President Biden and other world leaders have shied away from going after this because they were worried about the blowback on their own economies. If there's a shortage of oil, it's going to lead to higher fuel prices, higher heating costs, and general inflation in their own countries. And that was a pretty explicit decision that the Biden administration made. We're going to sanction Russia, but we're not going to cut off their oil completely. This doesn't cut off anything completely, but the idea that you're going harder after their oil seems like it seems like the kind of move that a lot of people would have applauded under a previous administration, and so I think it'll probably be well received now.
Although I think it's more symbolic than anything else. I mean, is this really going to affect Russia and Putin? The U.S. gets almost no oil from Russia right now anyway. So Russia's top oil customers are China and India, and China has an insatiable and growing need for oil. And they have shown themselves willing to be political allies with Russia. And so I don't know their ability to absorb whatever losses Russia may incur from these sanctions, but I think the losses will be minimal. I think that China can help make up whatever gap there will be. And even if that's not true, the third point here is that Putin has shown himself very willing and very resilient in terms of taking these kind of risks. And so I don't think it's going to deter Russia in the short term at all.
I agree. And my first point on my notes here, Malia, was India and China are the key here, right? Will the Trump administration understand fully? I'm sure they understand, but will they understand fully that the puzzle piece requires that there be secondary sanctions on the China and Indias of the world? Also, Bill, to get to your point about, you know, Biden tried the sanctions, and will the Trump administration fully understand what the press is calling the shadow fleet, right? This ability that Russia has and Putin has to circumvent sanctions by having tankers and trucks that don't bear the flag of Russia still delivering across lines. So I think there are lots of pieces to this. Let's talk a little bit about the numbers, right? The gas oil industry revenue accounts for 25% of the Russian federal budget. 25% of the Russian federal budget. I think Malia's right. I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference. But it didn't surprise me that Putin says this is going to hurt a little bit. If it's 25% of the Russian federal budget, that's significant. What are we talking about? $600 million a day of oil passes through Russia to other countries. That's $600 million is a significant amount of money. These two oil firms account for 3.1 million barrels of crude oil a day. They're about 100 million barrels. So it's 3.1% of the world's appetite for oil. You know, that's fairly significant. I do think, like Bill, I think you're right. I think it was a little late in coming. And the other piece that I'll throw out on the table before I yield the floor is Trump's, if I'm one of Trump's advisors, I say these sanctions are important. You've got to think about secondary sanctions. You also have to couple this with military aid to Ukraine, because sanctions alone are not going to make the difference in moving the needle on this particular war. Tomahawks should be back on the table, and if you couple sanctions with military aid, you might make some movement on stopping Putin. But until you do the second part, it's not going to happen.
It is striking. Putin, like, it's hard to keep track of these events, but there was a particularly awful strike on Ukraine, which hit a kindergarten and, you know, killed a lot of civilians.
Right.
That came after President Trump issued some kind of warning. So you wonder if there's going to be something now, you know, like he announces sanctions,
right.
Putin orders another strike. Putin does seem completely immune to the threats, the style of negotiation that President Trump engages in. And if anything, doubles down when he feels like the president is trying to push him around. So I'm not pretending that this will be an effective strategy. I feel like it might have been more effective if it had been implemented in cooperation with the rest of the world, with as much as possible of cooperation from China and India at the beginning of the war rather than, you know, several years into it.
So, can I go?
Go ahead.
Okay. So I think it's fascinating to think about what's happened over what, Bill, Joe, Malia, 10 days total we've gotten to this point. So
the back and forth.
The back and forth, right. So if you just take that slice of temporal of time, you know, Trump is this is the sequence of events. Trump considers long-range missiles for Ukraine. He calls Putin. He retracts the offer after the call for Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. He tells Zelensky he may have to cede the land already occupied by Russia. Trump sets up a summit in Hungary. It's ironic that it's in Hungary, but we'll let that slide. They get wind, right, that Putin won't budge. The White House gets wind that Putin's not going to budge in that summit. So Trump cancels the summit. Moscow is taken by surprise. Sanctions are the response for that. I do think this is an escalation, a significant escalation in Trump's attempt to prevent further war. I think he's emboldened by Gaza. I think this is an escalation, but as I said before, I think it needs more pieces.
There's so many things to hook into here. I don't think Trump really cares about peace all that much in Ukraine. I think he's trying to go hand to hand. It's kind of like, you know, an arm wrestling match with Putin, and he's just trying all these different ways to show that he's Putin's equal, because I think that's the person. Either Putin or Xi Jinping of China. Those are the world leaders that he really admires in many ways. And these sanctions, even if they did work, they're not going to. Economic sanctions are such sort of brutish and imprecise tools for accomplishing specific goals. So, I mean, to stop a war, it's always a complex matter, right? But cutting off a little bit of the money stream to the guy who has been prosecuting this war for years because he thinks it's one of his core national security interests isn't really, it's hard to see how that substantially contributes to bringing peace in Ukraine.
You're the international affairs expert in the room today, so I'm going to ask you this question because this morning, no, I don't. I think it's a bit of a softball, right? I think it's a bit of a softball. But this morning, I read that Modi, the leader of India, said we will ramp down our use of Russian oil. Do we think that's honest? And B, if it is a ramp down, does that make Putin take a step closer to the negotiating table?
I think it makes Putin take a step closer to China.
You think China takes up all of the...
I'm not sure if they... do they have the need? I mean, they have almost no domestic oil production themselves. So they... And this is why... this is why China has been focusing so much on building a blue water navy, a navy that's capable of going operating around the world offshore. This is why they have invested billions of dollars in ports around the world. They've transformed the port of Karachi, for example, and they're dotted around the world, and it's largely along the oil import lanes to China. So I don't know what kind of pipelines or whatever they have to Russia in particular, but... I think that the need is the demand is there. I'm not sure if China's leadership wants to fill all that demand now with Russia, but certainly over decades there hasn't been a lot of love lost between China and Russia. But I think even though ideologically they have their differences, they are closer now than they have been. In a generation, just the two leaders have similar styles, they have similar interests, and they've been able to support each other and each other's countries without much strategic risk.
Putin is increasingly isolated from the Western world, and so China has been kind of a fallback for him.
And part of their goal is they want to be more they want to be seen more and not just seen but actually want to be more active global leaders in a way. And so it burnishes their sort of internationalist credentials as well.
Yeah, listen to this. I thought this was super interesting data. So Trump announces the sanctions yesterday. No, a couple days ago, right? Trump announces the sanctions, and it triggered a 5% increase in oil prices. That compares to a 1.6% increase in oil prices when Great Britain announced a few days before Trump did that they were going to sanction Russia too. So, it also sort of says something about American production. American usage of oil. It's 20% of the world's oil is used by the United States every day. But it also says something about the inflated, I think if you're Trump, you're feeling bold and confident that you, as opposed to Europe, you can make a difference if oil prices go up, 300% compared to the UK, also a powerful country, can't get the needle to move.
I mean, I guess I'm not being an expert on international oil markets. I suspect that part of what's going on there is that...
We'll get with it.
Right. Part of what's going on there is that the markets are looking, they say Great Britain, they're like, that's interesting. That's a sign of something going on. And then when the U.S. jumps in, they're like, oh, this is real.
Yeah.
Like, apart from the relative consumption figures, they're recognizing, this is like a coordinated effort. They've been talking to each other, and other countries are going to get on board. They're sort of seeing the scope of it in a way that any one country making an announcement wouldn't have swung. It's just a suspicion.
Do you think there are any domestic political interests here in the United States that really are impacted by this, or is it Trump trying to flex his international muscles?
I think it's Trump trying to flex his international muscles because Bill, I think it was Bill who said we get none, or Malia, you said none of our oil imports from Russia to begin with.
Very, very little.
Yeah,
but if it raises oil prices, it's a negative thing politically.
Well, that's what's so interesting about what happened. So Biden tries the sanctions 10 days before he's leaving office, right? And the reason he waited so long to sanction Russian oil, he did the same thing. He picked two major companies and he sanctioned those two major companies. The reason he waited so long is because he was so burned with the inflation. You said this, Bill. He was so burned with inflation that he had no appetite a year before to raise prices in an environment in which people are paying $8 or $10 for eggs.
Well, I think Trump has a different relationship with Saudi Arabia for one, than Biden did, and is also much more willing to turn up domestic oil production.
True.
So he probably, to the extent that he and his team have considered that there may be a rise in oil prices, they probably feel like that's a problem they can solve pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that's true, but it's also interesting the data that Joe read before this segment and the increase in inflation that I think probably, overall, I think probably took them by surprise.
Hmm. Let's see. I think we have a couple of letters here, and I would like to get to those. Excuse me. Ray says, I agree that Tomahawks should be part of the equation. Stop making Ukraine fight with one arm tied behind their back and stop waffling with the other. Then we got this from Ellen, who says, if you listen to Planet Money on Russia's shadow fleet, these sanctions will not have the impact that we would like. The oil price will rise, but Russia will still be able to sell. That from Ellen. Let's move on to another topic that we can at least start discussing prior to the break. And there is the back and forth here of federal workers who are not working because of the shutdown and federal workers who are working because of the shutdown and their pay. And Senate Democrats on Thursday blocked legislation to pay federal employees who have been working without compensation during the government shutdown, thwarting Republicans' latest effort to weaken their hand in the federal spending fight. The defeat was part of a series of failed partisan votes on the 23rd day of the government shutdown that underscored the depths of the prolonged impasse, with neither Republicans nor Democrats showing any indication that they plan to relent and seek an off-ramp. Democrats say they opposed the GOP measure because it would hand President Trump wide latitude to pick and choose which workers receive compensation while the government is shuttered. Republicans, who offered the bill in part to bolster their argument that Democrats are to blame for any pain that results from the shutdown, contended they were merely catering to their restive progressive base. On a vote of 54 to 45, the measure fell short of the 60 votes it needed to advance. Three Senate Democrats crossed party lines to vote for it, including John Fetterman, John Ossoff, and Raphael Warnock, the last two from Georgia, Fetterman from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so it's just performative, Joe. The reality is, I mean, these are interesting stories to read. At this point, both sides are so entrenched and dug in that it's just theater now. And how we're going to get through the impasse, I'm not sure. It's going to be the longest government shutdown in American history. Remember, shutdowns only started in the Nixon administration, but it's going to be the longest. It's going to be more than the 35 days. I think when I listen to these politicians on both sides of the aisle and the disingenuousness of both of them, when John Thune and Mike Johnson stand up there and say, quote, we have nothing to negotiate with the Democrats, that's just flat out wrong. I'm sorry, my dad was a Republican. I'm sorry, Republican listeners out there. That's not true, that you don't. A clean bill, a clean piece of legislation doesn't mean you don't have things to negotiate. And Bill can tell us all about the way in which health care can be negotiated in this moment. So that's just disingenuous that we don't have anything to negotiate. On the flip side, Democrats digging in on health care because, again, as David Brooks said this morning, it's a topic that they can run with as opposed to what they really want to run with, which is the fragility of democracy that nobody seems to care about. That too is disingenuous to hold hostage a lot in the healthcare subsidies as a vehicle to try to get at Trump. That's disingenuous too. So whether they're going to pay workers or not, or vote in favor of paying workers who are furloughed or not, it's performative and it is symbolic of the fact that the American political system is broken.
So the thing that's at the heart of this is the separation of powers. Like the Congress is supposed to approve spending. And so the federal government can't spend money unless there's an appropriation, except under limited circumstances, which apparently the limited circumstances include keeping certain functions, necessary functions of government open, but not paying the employees. So what the Republicans want is a simple, what they call a continuing resolution that will just like a vote that authorizes the spending to continue as it normally does. But this is a pressure point for the Democrats. They're like, well, they need some of our votes to do this because we need a supermajority in the Senate. And they're withholding those votes. So I think if you just look at it on that level, they're the ones who are withholding votes that are causing the government to be quote unquote shut down. And they're doing that, I think it's really just to perform their opposition to Trump writ large. Like everything about him offends them, it offends their base, and they want to show their opposition. But the thing that they've asked for at the bargaining table, I mean, technically, I think they're asking for two things. One is basically to undo the big, beautiful bill, specifically the health care cuts in the big, beautiful bill. It's $1 trillion in spending over a decade. That's a big ask, I think it's fair to say. But then they've also put their finger on the enhanced tax credits, which were already due to expire. The big, beautiful bill didn't change anything about that. But the Democrats are saying, we don't want these to expire. And in fact, they're saying your own voters don't want these to expire, meaning Republican voters, because in fact, Republicans use these enhanced tax credits, or residents of Republican states use these enhanced tax credits more than residents of Democratic states. They've seized on healthcare because it works for them politically. It polls well. They have more trust among voters when it comes to health policy than Republicans do. But it's something that they've chosen to put on the table. It's not inherent in a continuing resolution that you would do anything about healthcare, that you would reverse the expiration of tax credits, or you would reverse spending cuts from a previous bill. I think what the Republicans were trying to do with this latest vote was they were trying to sharpen the situation. They were trying to say, listen, you are now voting against paying the people who are working for the federal government. They're essential workers. We've asked them to stay on the job. We think they should be paid. We're not asking you to vote for a complete continuing resolution. Just pay these people. And the Democrats still voted no. So they're trying to sharpen the issue. And the Democrats came back with their own counter proposals. Well, how about we pay all the employees? And Thune's like, well, there's a continuing resolution. You could vote for that. So there's a lot of tit for tat, and it's not getting us anywhere. Ultimately, the president's going to have to come in and broker a deal.
We're going to take a very quick underwriting break. We'll be right back here from Malia and finish out on this Friday morning. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A great group this morning: Bo Breslin, Bill Hammond, Malia Dumont. And as we finish up for this morning, Malia, your thoughts on this particular topic of Democrats blocking a federal worker pay bill as the shutdown drags on?
Well, I was thinking about the shutdown and one community that, or one group of people that it particularly affects that we should be paying attention to is county level executives, organizations, because that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, with regard to federal spending. So when the federal government approves healthcare spending, who actually delivers the healthcare? Many times it's through county level government organizations. They have a role in being a pass through in many ways. And so it's budget season right now, and these county executives are trying to shape budgets, plan for the coming year when they're not entirely sure how much money is going to be coming in. I mean, it could be, they already know there are going to be significant cuts, but on top of the significant cuts that have already taken place, there could be more cuts coming. And so it makes it really difficult for our local government officials who are the ones who are, you know, serving our neighbors every single day. It makes it really hard for them to do their jobs well.
Hear, hear. I agree, and let's not take our eyes off the prize here. But the interesting thing is, we were talking during the break about the fact that there seems to be largely apathy about the shutdown, or you know, not everybody, folks who are furloughed, not getting paid, and so on. My heart breaks for them, but the public does not seem to be as fired up about this particular shutdown as they were about the 35-day one at the end of the Trump administration and some of the earlier ones. I think that's a symptom.
There's so many other things to be fired up about.
It's true, and I think that's a symptom of both the political chaos that we're living in, but also I think it's a symptom of the fact that there is a collective sense that government can't do for us what it used to do in the first place. And so why even, you know, spend a lot of energy thinking about it? And that worries me in this environment, if we sort of collectively shrug or just throw our hands up and say, what can we do? You know, that's not the citizenship or the polity that I'd like to live in.
The one reason that it hasn't drawn more attention, I believe, is that the functions of government are basically continuing. I mean, there aren't a lot of things that we do on a day-to-day basis that have stopped. I'm imagining that certain parks have been closed, but unless, if you're not going to the park, I guess another area that people freak out about is the possibility of not having an air traffic controller when they're trying to land in an airport. And so,
isn't that what forced the end of the last shutdown? The concerns about the air traffic controllers?
Yeah, if you're planning a trip abroad, or you know,
a Thanksgiving
long trip,
that's right. Yeah, Thanksgiving.
There could be even more chaos around that. But like for the time being,
I want no chaos on that.
Right.
I want everything just going smooth as a baby's bottom.
You see the same thing in Albany when a regular occasion is that the fiscal year ends and they don't have a new budget. And they do these continuing resolutions. But the effect of the continuing resolutions is to keep the government going. And so like, there is no continuing resolution in Washington, but over time they developed all these practices that keep business as usual moving along without a continuing resolution, and that it mutes the impact of everything until it gets to a crisis point where you know, the traffic controllers just stop showing up for work or something like that. That would be like that. It's interesting you bring up Thanksgiving, because that is,
it's a forcing function for sure.
That's mm-hmm. that's a chaotic moment, even when all the air traffic controllers are on duty. And if they're not on duty,
I know.
Yeah, that's going to piss people off.
People leave kids at the airport, and then there's movies about it, and then they're still alone, and it's just a mess.
Nice.
We're out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us. It's very nice to be in your company, as always. I wonder what we'll... You sit here and you think, oh, I wonder what Monday will bring.
Rather not think about it.
Will the sports gambling story still have legs on Monday?
Yes. You know, we talked about it. I feel kind of feel good about this because we did, as it was a breaking yesterday, we did get to address the story and some of the issues about bringing gambling so close to team sports and professional sports. Close in the sense of their gambling parlors in the
stadiums, yeah,
as well as the ads that are constantly going telling you, you know, if you bet on this play, you could make this much money. So we can certainly we'll keep our eye on that. Bill Hammond, Bo Breslin, and Malia Dumont, have a beautiful weekend. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.